Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Exotics Club webinar. I am delighted to welcome our speaker for today, clinician in rabbit, exotic animal and wildlife medicine and surgery, Bronwyn Cotterwas. Thank you, Bronwyn. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks so much for having me and welcome everyone to the webinar. Hopefully this will be helpful for you. I think anorexia in tortoises is one of the most common presenting complaints we have, and you might have come across it already in practice, but hopefully today we'll walk through a couple of tips and tricks on how to help diagnose it. We'll talk about initially what is anorexia in a tortoise, and then we'll talk about some primary causes, diagnostics, and end with a bit of supportive care. Now, anorexia can be a really, really vague sign, can't it? It's just a tortoise who's not been eating. Often people won't know how long that's been happening or won't really be able to quantify how much the tortoise is or isn't eating. The vegetable material offered often wilts or gets trampled upon, so it might be really difficult for someone to pick up on early or really tell you fully about. And I kind of equate anorexia in tortoises to gut stasis in a rabbit or even headache in us, in that it could be really a sign of something else going on, whether it's in the environment that's causing it to go off food, or another primary disease process going on as well. So it's really important for us to kind of thoroughly investigate as much as possible, just so we're not missing any other issues we can be taking care of. So just imagine that this is your patient. It's arrived to you. The owner's saying that it's not been eating for maybe even several weeks, and it's your job to figure out why and to fix it. Where are you going to start? Well, really, the best place to start is, first of all, figuring out what kind of tortoise you have and what it's meant to be eating, its physiology and habitat would go a long way into figuring out why it might be anorectic. History is a major part of our examination and in helping us identify particular deficits, either in husbandry or concerns in the health of the animal or other animals. Is this a solitary tortoise that's anorexic, or are there other ones that have gone off the feed as well? And then, of course, you come to your examination after that. Well, you'll be guided for your questions in the clinical exam. Your history taking will be guided by what we know about husbandry requirements for tortoises. And so just to walk through as a bit of reminder, these are kind of the five key bits of husbandry, along with diet and water as well. But if we think about space for a tortoise, we obviously want enough space for that tortoise to be doing what it needs to be doing to have an enriched life. And we want the tortoise to be on a substrate that's not going to be harmful to it, causing impactions or partial obstructions. We want to make sure that the heat is adequate, and we think about that that preferred optimum temperature zone, and we typically think about it being quite high at about 24 to 38 degrees Celsius, but we know that overnight it can dip down to about 15 or 18 as well, and they want a range in their tortoise box or enclosure. Humidity, people often don't record humidity, but typical kind of room humidity in a house might be around 50%, so that might be adequate for a tortoise, again, depending on species. And then finally, light. We all know that they need full UV spectrum a certain distance away from the animal, and that those bulbs can dissipate UV quite quickly, and so we usually advise rechanging those bulbs every 6 months to make sure that they're putting out optimum UV. Now, what people don't often think about is if their tortoise is ambling about either in the house or in a greenhouse, is that they might not be actually exposed to that UV light source as often as they want it to be. So they might need to put multiple light sources in there for the tortoise. So those kind of key bits of husbandry will help, again, guide your history taking. And then also what you knew about diet for tortoises, obviously being herbivores, most of them are the common ones that we tend to see. They'll mainly be eating weeds and grass and other leafy vegetable matter that we can offer them. Just make sure that you're also asking owner about supplementation. We typically advise giving a calcium supplementation a few times a week and a multivitamin a couple of times a week. So you're not only asking the frequency with which the owner's giving that, but how are they doing it? Is the tortoise actually eating what they're offering? That kind of thing. So really pick apart that bit of the history as well. And then don't forget hydration and water. Does the tortoise have other access to water sources just outside of its vegetable matter? Is it bathed? Does it have a bowl or a tub of water that it can soak preferentially in and drink from as well? So definitely ask questions about that. And if it's a species that's hibernating, you want to be getting a full history on how it's hibernated. Is it hibernated in the past with success? Have there been issues before? Have there been new issues this year? Is it the first time hibernating? Is there a new setup involved? All of these kind of questions, because certainly when we think about anorexia and tortoises, historically one of the main causes might be post-hibernation anorexia. So you really want to get some good ideas of whether this was optimum hibernation or suboptimal. And other problems with hibernation can be dehydration that we see. If they're hibernated outside, then they might have frostbite damage. The dehydration can lead to renal failure. If they're compromised, they can be susceptible to upper respiratory tract infections, whether that's bacterial or viral, and certainly lower respiratory tract as well. So after all of that good history taking, hopefully you have some clues that might guide you into figuring out where the anorexia might be coming from, and you're ready to get onto your clinical exam. Just remember that a tortoise that presents to you really cold is going to look horrible. It's going to look moribund, and that might really change your treatment plan or indeed your prognosis even. So if you have a tortoise that comes to you hypothermic, make sure you're warming it up ahead of the clinical exam so that you get an actual fair assessment of what's going on. In your clinical exam, it's going to be truncated compared to other species because you'll just have minimal access given the shell. We won't really have the ability to auscultate effectively. We can take heart rate with using a Doppler, but resp rate and body temperature are going to be more difficult. We can get obviously a body weight, and that's going to really help us with monitoring later down the road with regard to response to treatment. And you can body condition score. We can decide if this is a lean tortoise or an overweight tortoise, which we would look for kind of salomic fill, I suppose, if you want to put it that way, or just how much fat stores are in the tortoise or muscle mass. And then we'll just do a typical head-to-tail examination and as much of a salomic palpation as you can. In your head-to-toe examination, you might get some indicators as to why your tortoise is anorectic to begin with. So you can see this tortoise has a really markedly overgrown beak. And with just a bit of burring, we've corrected that, and now it's off eating again. So clinical exams are critical and might be a very simple reason why your tortoise isn't eating. Again, I mentioned before, salomic palpation is going to be a bit tricky given the shell in your way, but you can do the best you can. Just warn the owner that you can really only feel so much with your fingers, and you might have to do further diagnostics to really have a better assessment of internal organs or structures. And finally, we want to be able to assess bone density or shell pliability by gently kind of pressing on the carapace and the plastron and seeing if there's any pliability there that might be an indicator of a metabolic bone disease or nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism, which would be another one of the main reasons that a tortoise might be anorexic. So with all of these things before I've said, those will hopefully help you get a little bit closer to a reason why your tortoise might be off its food. But again, we're going to need to warn the owner that really, diagnostics are going to really be needed to treat the tortoise as best as possible. The anorexia might be multifactorial, and you'd want to be able to address all of those issues. As I said before, and really why we focus on the history taking so much is probably the biggest factor with regard to anorexia in a tortoise is poor husbandry. So if we can get those husbandry issues sorted, the tortoise will, with just a bit of supportive care, hopefully get back to eating just fine in its new and improved environment. We'll continue to talk a little bit about the metabolic bone disease or the nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism. And then we'll talk about other issues that might be affecting anorexia, GI obstruction, respiratory illnesses, reproductive disease, fatty liver disease, and kidney disease as well. So off we go, talking about metabolic bone disease, and we all know about this. It can be caused by improper calcium to phosphorus ratio, or just a pure calcium deficiency, or even a hypovitaminosis D. And the primary signs of it are, like we said, some shell pliability, lethargy, anorexia. In severe cases, you might see some erythema or bruising on the shell. So this little tortoise actually has bruising contact points from where it's bumped into other things with such a soft shell. And this little tortoise has some fractures across its scoot line. So if you see these in your patient, you'll want to make sure that you're handling them really, really gently. You don't want to cause any iatrogenic fractures. And also be aware that there might already be other pathologic fractures in a case like this. And we know that anorexia is a result of metabolic bone disease simply because of the decrease of muscle contraction, muscle movement. It can also cause tetany or spasticity. It can cause a lot of different changes across conduction of muscle fibers, and certainly the GI tract would be involved. Next, we move on to true primary gastrointestinal diseases, whether that's a fecal impaction from overeating or secondary to dehydration, or eating the wrong thing. Is it eating substrate, like a bit of cocoa fiber, or is it eating a little bit of pebbles in the garden, which would lead us on to an actual foreign body? Or is there a space-occupying mass in the salomic cavity that's causing some decreased GI motility and therefore a secondary impaction? And we need to think about endoparasites as well. So we know that tortoises can carry a certain low load of parasites without causing a problem. And it's just when it reaches higher levels that we'll be wanting to treat. But certainly if you have a debilitated tortoise that's anorexic, if we see a moderate level of parasites, we're going to go ahead and treat them anyway, just to rule out that being an issue. Coming on to respiratory diseases now, we'll start with upper respiratory diseases. So we know that mycoplasma is one of the top two causes of upper respiratory disease in tortoises. So make sure you're looking for nasal discharge, swollen eyes or periorbital region, and history as well, if they've been exposed to other tortoises with mycoplasma. And herpes virus is the other one. So along with the signs that we've talked about with the mycoplasma infection, you might also see a stomatitis. And we can't forget pneumonia, either as an extension of upper respiratory tract disease or primary. I know we're talking about tortoises, so it's a little bit cheeky for me to throw in a terrapin photo, but just to remind you, you can see buoyancy changes when they have a pneumonia, a unilateral pneumonia. Or certainly we'll pick up, and our tortoises will pick up on it in some imaging. Reproductive disease might be a primary cause of anorexia simply because of the space occupying factor of them, or maybe there's other issues involved. Maybe it's been an ongoing dystocia or stasis that the owner's not picked up on. Now, what we need to figure out is whether it's actually a pathologic problem. Now, you might radiograph a tortoise with anorexia and just find eggs by chance, but do you know that they're really causing an issue? You don't really. You just know that the tortoise is anorexic, and maybe it's anorexic for another reason. But we tend to just go ahead and treat it as if it is, and so encourage passing of those eggs. And oftentimes, once those eggs are passed, the tortoise will start eating again, absolutely fine. And we need to talk about fatty liver disease as well. Obviously, that's usually secondary to going off food, to not eating very well, or it can be due to other disease going on. But we always have fatty liver disease in our heads. As either something to worry about initially, or certainly something to keep an eye out for it down the road as our tortoise is recovering. And the same with renal disease. I mentioned before that we can see kidney disease in tortoises that are dehydrated during hibernation, or when they're poorly hibernated, or with other issues. Or it can kind of creep up on us as another illness that we see as the disease process is going on. Certainly, we tend to think about it, think about gout and other reptiles, but we often forget to think about the impact that metabolic bone disease has on the kidneys. We know that elevated parathyroid hormone can cause kidney damage in tortoises that have metabolic bone disease. So that's why we kind of like to monitor kidney values and renal function in tortoises that are just kind of waxing and waning with anorexia. The idea that just like with the hepatic lipidosis, that we might see it crop up down the road. So after going through all of that, where do we start? We've talked about a lot of diseases that could cause it. It could be everything from husbandry mistakes to actual pathology going on. Where do we start? And usually, of course, we've mentioned that we start with changing husbandry anyway, or advising on improvements. But we really need to get on with some diagnostics to figure out if there's anything else going on with the tortoise. So we'll start with just a quick whiz through blood sampling techniques. I know you are all really familiar with this, but just in case, we'll do a quick run through where to get blood on tortoises and how much. So just make sure that you are warming your patient first. It would make it a lot easier to get a blood sample, and we can get that from the jugular vein, which I personally find a little bit tricky sometimes, especially in a collapsed patient. The right side can sometimes be easier, although if you're right-handed, perhaps the left side is a little bit easier for you. But again, if you warm the patient, and certainly if you hydrate it, you might have an easier time accessing the jugular. Just be aware that you can have hematoma formation. So this poor little tortoise didn't have its venipuncture site held off quite long enough and has a hematoma resulting secondary. So just be aware you will need to be able to do that because there's quite a bit of decreased skin elasticity and recoil in reptiles. And we have the option of the coccygeal vein, which I think is probably my last choice. It's a bit tricky. And then the subcarapacial sinus. So there's pretty easy access to this site. I'm sure you've done it before. Just be aware that you can get hemolymph dilution or lymph dilution. You'll still probably have a decent sample though for a general biochemistry, although your hematology is going to be affected. And just again to run through hematology, just to remind you that some key differences between tortoise hematology in mammals is obviously they have the nucleated red blood cell that has quite a long lifespan, and that they have heterophils rather than neutrophils. Most of the time we'll be sending away our blood samples to a lab, but just in case you are looking at smears in-house. And if you are getting biochemistry results back from the laboratory, just to be aware of what parameters to actually really be focusing on. We don't often get many, many changes in liver values, even when there is hepatic lipidosis going on or other hepatopathies. So we tend to focus on these parameters that I've listed, that these tend to be the most helpful, really. Don't forget to do a fecal screen as well. It would be a bit silly, wouldn't it, to not rule out something so simple in an anorectic tortoise. If you're going to have it in your hospital, it'd be easy enough to treat it if it did have an elevation in endoparasites. And people often ask us this when they come to see us for health checks. Well, why don't we just worm routinely? Well, you'll know, being knowledgeable vets, that we don't, not only because we don't want to cause resistance, but certainly the products that we use can have side effects. And just to remind you as well that ivermectin is not to be used in tortoises because it can cause that fatal flaccid paralysis. We often don't think about urinalysis in reptiles, and the value might be a bit questionable, but if you do get a urine sample, you can always give it a go looking at it. The most valuable might be specific gravity, and sometimes when we have a dehydrated tortoise, that could give us indicators as to response to treatment, changes in specific gravity. We'll chat a little bit more about that later on. You can look, you can test a dipstick, and you can look at the sample, a sedimentation sample. Other techniques, I like to remind our students that if there's any swelling, if there's any discharge, if there's anything that looks abnormal, we can sample it. We can fine needle aspirate it. We can do a cytology. We can do an impression smear. We can do a wash. There's so many things we can do. And so don't be put off again by the shell and the scales and the head retracting in. There are things that we can do to get more diagnostics, so you can hopefully identify the primary cause of the anorexia and treat your patient as best as possible. Certainly, well, this little tortoise is having a nasal flush. Certainly, if it doesn't seem like it's the right thing to do, don't do it. But we can do flushes and washes to get some sample for cytology, for culture. And there are PCR tests that are really easy to get for herpes and mycoplasma virus. I'm sorry, herpes virus and mycoplasma. Just a coanal swab or a conjunctival swab, and that will give us a really good idea of whether those diseases are present in your patient. This tortoise is actually having a transtracheal wash, and that again would give us a good idea whether there's lower respiratory tract disease. You can do cytology and culture on that as well. And doing the cytology in-house would be just the same as any other animal, but you might send it away. Culture and sensitivity might be a little bit different because we know that the kind of biogram, I suppose, of reptiles vary than typical mammals. So you just might need to give your laboratory a heads up when they're thinking about augers to use, or certainly sensitivity discs to be using, based on what would actually be antibiotics that you would use to treat. And on to imaging. I think in an anorexic tortoise, probably the most important imaging that we can do is just a radiograph. I know here we always talk about fancy CT and advanced imaging and things, but If an anorexic tortoise comes to us, the first thing we'll do is maybe a bit of a blood smear, but certainly an x-ray, just to make sure it doesn't have eggs or ingesta impaction or bone density changes. It's just simple enough to do, isn't it? And easy to do conscious. We can just set them on a platform or just set them on a plate, and they tend to do absolutely fine. Certainly, they'll stay still long enough for us to take a diagnostic radiograph. Sometimes people, we talk about this vasovagal reflex in other reptiles, and you can certainly try it in a tortoise. And that would simply mean you just put a little bit of gentle pressure on its eyes, or you could even just put a little bit of bandage material, or just very, very gently put a little bit of vet wrap around its head, just to keep those eye a bit of pressure on the orbits and trigger that vasovagal reflex. But you're always going to want to be doing three views, really. So hopefully you've got an x-ray machine that can do a horizontal beam. It just makes life a lot simpler. If not, you could rig up a device that would, or some kind of structure that would keep the tortoise in kind of lateral recumbency while you're trying to take a radiograph. And with these radiographs, we can see a lot. Really, this tortoise has decreased bone density, so it's at risk for nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism. This tortoise has a bladder stone, so that would be an indicator as to why it might be off its food or anorexic if it's got that intracelomic mass. One with eggs, hopefully that would be obvious, but you can see these eggs look like they're going to pass fine, don't they? One of them is aligned and should pass through that pelvic canal, so you can be a little bit confident that will pass with just a bit of medical management without surgical intervention. And looking at a lateral beam radiograph, you can assess lung field and see if there's any lung changes that would be consistent with pneumonia, if there's any consolidation there. But also we're looking at the, I'm sorry, I apologize for this radiograph being a bit wonky, but you can just see, if I just get the pointer out, how this kind of material in the celomic cavity is really impinging on the respiratory tract. So that would give us an indicator that there's going to be either some GI impaction, obstruction, or other intracelomic mass that's causing that kind of dorsal encroachment into the lung fields. And don't forget about barium studies as well. We often panic a little bit, I suppose, when it comes to diagnostics and exotics, but don't forget you can do a barium series. It just might take ages for things to pass through fully with a transit time of 21 days, but that's still going to be diagnostic for you, isn't it? You just know that you don't have to have the time frame that you would for a mammal. Perhaps just have the tortoise in every few days to watch the passing of that contrast material, and you should be able to have highlighted any foreign bodies, or certainly any areas of narrowing of the GI tract. And of course, sometimes I feel like it wouldn't be a webinar from us without mentioning CT, but so many first opinion practices or secondary hospitals have CT or the ability to send for CT now, and I think it really is a great way to, in a non-invasive way, get some wonderful images without that, especially without the shell getting in the way. And you can see in this CT image that tortoise has quite a severe consolidation of the lung field. And don't forget as well about more advanced techniques like endoscopy. Now, we would not obviously turn to endoscopy, not in the first instance. We would try to treat our anorexic tortoise first with supportive care and do all the preliminary diagnostics. But if it wasn't responding, if it was waxing and waning, still not eating on its own, then we would turn to endoscopy, and usually we would recommend a celioscopy just to have a look inside and be able to biopsy any organs that are looking abnormal. So now we've thought about all of those things. You hopefully you're going to have the tortoise in your hospital now. And just remember, back to that first image I had of the tortoise in the kennel. Now that's not a bad way to have a tortoise for short term. Certainly this tortoise is a little bit better set up with its tortoise box and a little bit more enrichment and a UV light. Hopefully it's got a heat gradient as well. So really whatever's within your capability, but just know that if it's just going to be short term, you probably can get away without UV and all the extra bells and whistles that they need for long-term management. In the hospital, weighing them daily is going to be the primary indicator that we have that there's a positive response to treatment. We know that tortoise bladders can hold up to 25% of their body weight. So initially we expect quite a weight gain, and then we expect it to level off a bit. And that would give us an idea that the tortoise is actually absorbing hydration that we're giving it and responding well. Thermal support is critical because a tortoise that isn't warm within its preferred optimum temperature zone won't actually be metabolizing the treatment that we're giving it. So it won't be absorbing in the fluids properly. It won't be metabolizing the medications you're giving it, whether that's antibiotics or analgesia. And it certainly won't be utilizing any supplemental feeds that we're giving it as well. So just to remind you, though, we really do need to focus on warmth and rewarming that animal initially before we jump right to nutrition. So warmth and hydration is often what we do first. And then we, even though it's the tortoise has been anorexic, we turn to supplemental feeds if needed, after we're confident that they've been hydrated, because we don't want this refeeding syndrome to happen. I have seen it happen in the past when people get a little bit excited about providing everything, every type of supportive care to any animal. In the first instance, they just don't have the capability to process it properly and can succumb to refeeding syndrome. So just remember, heat, hydration, and then once that's stable, then you can go on to nutrition. And how are we going to improve hydration? And how often do we need to do it? Well, just remember that maintenance rate for reptiles is about 30 mils per kilo per day, so quite a bit lower than other mammals that we think of. Certainly when we're thinking about rabbits and exotic small mammals, that can be up to 100 mils per kilo per day. So quite a lot lower for these animals with a lower metabolic rate. In the past, we used to worry about what product to use, and now we think that actually Hartmann's is fair enough. We used to talk about using saline in the past because it perhaps had better osmolarity, but or more aligned to reptile plasma. But we're happy with Hartmann's, really. It seems to work fine. We've not had any negative issues with it. And you can see it falls kind of, within the range. It's not too far out of saline. There's a lot of ways we can provide hydration. We can give that orally. Certainly in the first instance, they might not absorb it orally as well as they will parenterally. So we'll just quickly talk about different ways to offer that parenterally. And I've said environmental hydration. That might just be offering it a dish of water, increasing the humidity, or bathing it. So often when we have reptiles and tortoises that are anorexic in the hospital, we'll bathe them twice a day, up to 30 minutes, and that's a really good way for them to kind of self-regulate how much hydration that they're taking in, so they're not getting overhydrated. And we use these little plant propagators. They're a nice way to put a bit of shallow water in there. The plant propagators keep the warm water warm so that you're not chilling your tortoise. And they've got a nice lid so that your tortoise isn't escaping on you. And you can add in a bit of electrolyte powder if you want to. There's it's not much science really about how much to offer, but I feel much better about using a product like RepToBoost rather than what you might see on some forums about people adding in Leucozade or other products like that to the bathwater. I think there's just too much other additives in those kind of human products to safely add into the bathwater of a reptile. And bathing it will also be a good opportunity for it to pass any feces or urine and urates and give you a sense of whether your hydration is working. Oral hydration can be given by a metal tube, I'm sorry, feeding tube, or gavage needle as they're also called. Just make sure you pre-measure it to about the middle of the plastron. And tortoises, if you can get their head out, are usually fairly easy to syringe feed or hydrate because they're glottalized at the base of their tongue, and it is difficult to put the tube in the wrong place, really, but do watch what you're doing carefully so that you're not accidentally causing an aspiration pneumonia. You can give fluids intrasalomically, and that would just be given in that prefemoral fossa area with the head tipped down just a little bit so organs are falling out of the way. Or episalomic, which is the similar idea, but in that potential space between the neck and the forelimb. And don't forget, there's also intracystic. So tortoises have bladders, which is different than a lot of other reptile species. And so you can actually instill some fluid into their cloaca or bladder, and that is a site of water resorption and electrolyte balance as well. So just a bit of a recap, we're aiming for about 1% body weight offered orally twice a day. We can give parental fluids at about 1% body weight twice a day and bathe it for about 30 minutes twice a day. So hopefully between all of that, we're going to be giving about 4% of body weight per day of supplemental fluids. As I mentioned before, we'll be monitoring that weight change and expecting that initial rise as the tortoise is getting rehydrated, and then it should plateau. Monitoring urine we can do, and the specific gravity will hopefully decrease. So if it's over kind of 10.34, then we're a little bit more confident that we are dealing with a dehydrated tortoise. Now we're on to nutrition. So after you've gotten your patient warmed and hydrated, and you're confident that it is hydrated because it's passing urine and it's just looking more hydrated, its eyes aren't sunken, its skin isn't as wrinkly. Now we can think about giving it supplemental feed. Now you can see from this tortoise, this is usually when they're feeling better and usually when it's difficult to get the head pulled out of the shell. So it can be a bit tricky. Just remember, we tend to think about giving 1% of body weight via a stomach tube or a metal feeding tube. And the frequency of that just depends on how debilitated it is. So oftentimes in hospital, we're doing that once a day or twice a day, so not too frequent because transit time is so slow. Remember to keep them warm pre and post tubing, and you might even want to warm up the feed that you're offering. And I've written, allow it to digest before the next meal. It's really just to be cautious when you're giving the nutrition so that you're not causing an impaction, and also make sure that you're watching the oral cavity as you're giving it so that we aren't causing an aspiration pneumonia. And you can see in this photo that the glottis is fairly easy to see at the base of that tail, I'm sorry, base of the tongue, and you'd be able to pass the feeding tube just past that fine. But what product are we going to use? What are you going to use to actually refeed your tortoise who's anorectic? We tend to start with just an electrolyte product with a bit of sugar in it, perhaps, a bit of glucose. And the Vedox Critical Care Formula is fine for that. And then we can move up to another product that might have more carbohydrates or proteins in it, and more balanced nutrition, as we're sure that the tortoise will handle the feedings fine. So it just depends on what kind of species you have, what product you're picking, but these are often things we're turning to in hospital. And just to, again, to remind you, the risks of tube feeding, not only the difficulties of actually getting that head out of the shell a little bit so you can feed them properly, but also there's aspiration pneumonia. There is risk of perforating an esophagus in a really dehydrated animal, and regurgitation. So what other ways can we give them nutrition? If they're not eating on their own, we have to get some food into them, or we're at risk of hepatic lipidosis. And if force feeding them is not an option, then we really need to seriously think about an esophagostomy tube placement. Now, this might be a bit daunting to think about, but hang on with me. I can talk you into it, I think. There are lots of benefits of an O-tube. You don't have to be worrying about pulling that head out anymore. You won't have to be worrying about aspiration pneumonia, regurgitation. You can give larger volume feeds. The owner can do it at home, and oftentimes owners are really quite happy to do it at home. It feels like they're doing something to help their anorectic tortoise out, and they really get on board with it. And we also remind them, they seem quite surprised when we say that the tortoise can actually eat around the tube fine. So when we place an O-tube, we might leave it in for weeks, sometimes in some cases even months. The tortoise can eat around it fine. It might fall out of its own accord, or we might decide to take it out when the tortoise is stable again. There are risks, though. It does require a bit of a heavy sedation or a light GA, so this is not something we would be doing in a really, really, really debilitated tortoise. We would make sure that we have its hydration and heat up, and we would have given it a bit of nutrition before we put it through this process. There is the risk of lacerating a jugular or carotid. You remember the diagram when we were talking about blood sampling. And the tortoise can pull them out as well, so their front legs can just hook that esophageal feeding tube when they're feeling better and nick it out. But if it's feeling that good, then it might not need the tube anymore anyway. It might be eating on its own fine. So here we go. When we think about O-tube placement in tortoises, just think about how you do it in a cat. It's not too much different, really. You will need a bit of, like I said, sedation or anesthesia. I'll give you a list in a moment about other things to use, but this is the combination that we tend to use: a bit of an anti-inflammatory, a bit of an opioid for extra pain relief and pre-medication, and then we give alfaxolone, and that gives us just enough heavy sedation or light anesthesia to place an O2, which might be about kind of 15-minute procedure. Here are some other options for pain relief. I just thought I'd add them in here. Analgesia, not only assessing pain and the response to analgesia, but is difficult in all reptiles, but also just picking an analgesic that consistently works in that species is quite tricky. So you might have to turn to other resources if you've got an odd species that you're working on, to see if there's been studies done on a particular analgesic. And the same with anesthetics. These are typical combinations that people use. Like I said, we're using alfaxolone quite a lot for these little mini procedures like O2 placement, but there are other options for you as well. So here we go, just to walk through what we're going to do. So if you've got your animal asleep, you're just going to gently pull out their neck, extend their neck. You would have pre-measured a feeding tube. That's the appropriate size. You would have measured that all the way to the middle bit of the plastron. Some people like to cut them at that point, so it's shorter. You don't have to worry about coiling a long bit of tube. Or some people just put a marker, or a bit of pen line around the tube to give you an idea of how far to place it. And then you'll place your curved hemostats into the mouth with the curved bit facing laterally. And we do this really to displace the jugular and carotid vessels, because we don't want to be lacerating those. And this is a really good technique. I've used straight and curved before, and I really do prefer curved. I think this is a good trick because it really does kind of move everything out of the way, so you're just dealing with soft tissue structures. You'll elevate those hemostats just a bit so you can palpate it externally with your finger. You can incise just really gently with a scalpel over those hemostat tips that have been placed into the animal. Whether you just open the jaws a little bit or keep them closed, just be aware. Both techniques are absolutely fine, and I tend to open the jaws on my hemostat a little bit so that I've got a little bit of a guide for my my scalpel blade to go through. But if I do that, I'm very aware that I'm not going to be pinching off or closing my hemostats, or I'm going to be very cautious so I don't cause trauma to the esophagus. Then you'll advance your hemostats through that little hole you've made with your scalpel blade. You'll grab the distal end of your feeding tube that you've pre-measured, and you'll pull it out the mouth. So here's a tortoise that you can see has its feeding tube placed down really quite proximal down the neck. Now it just really depends, I'm sorry, terrapin. It really just depends on the anatomy of the animal in this area, whether you go very distal or if you can get away with kind of mid area. So what we tend to do is we'll take the leg, the forelimb, and we'll kind of move, extend it and flex it and just get an idea of where we can place the tube based on the access to the leg and the ability for the animal to actually get it out, nick it out with that front limb. And then this is a tricky bit people, I think, have the most trouble with. You wrap it around itself and push it back down the mouth. And now you're passing it kind of orally into the esophagus. And you give it a little, as it's passing where its entry point on the neck, then you can give it a little tug and it should even out and go straight. You can radiograph these to make sure that they are in place properly. But most of the time, you'll be absolutely fine, to be honest. You would have visualized the glottis, so you'll know you're not down trachea. And there is not any instances that I know of where a tortoise has coughed out its tube like you'd have in a cat. So that's one less thing you have to worry about. So if finances are a concern and the owner can't afford a confirmatory radiograph to show that the O-tube is in the right place, you'll probably be okay. Now, suturing it in place was whatever method you want to use, really. So typically, what I like to do is take a bite on either side, kind of laterally and medially into the skin, fairly large bites, and then do a Roman sandal style suture pattern up the tube to really secure it nicely. I've seen a lot of tubes come out when they've just been secured, when there's just one anchor point on one side. So having two anchor points helps me sleep better at night and has a better success rate with the tubes. And then you can see we've just coiled that O-tube onto the top of the plastron, or if it's a feeding tube that you've pre-measured, then you can just tape it on. The owner might need to be given some tape to repeat this process if it gets dirty at home, or if the tortoise starts feeling better, they might try really hard to scrape it off on furniture in its enclosure, or indeed if it's going outside, it might get a little bit mucky. So the owners might need to be versed in how to keep that tube clean and make sure it's secure. And I'm also usually telling them the kind of number, you know, all the feeding tubes are measured or graduated. They've got the numbers to look at to know how far the feeding tube has been advanced. And I usually tell the owner what number to look out for so that they can tell us if they feel like it's slipping out a little bit, and that'll give us an indicator as to whether we need to intervene. And you can also see that this tortoise has had its front limb bandaged, and that's simply to help prevent it from pulling out its tube or getting its tube caught on it, the scales of its front limb as it's trying to clean its face. So as they're starting to eat, tortoises typically wipe their faces with their front limbs, and that could put the tube at risk for coming out. So this is what you're left with, and this is a tortoise who's had the O2 place. It's just recovering on a bit of a heat mat. But I just, after talking about kind of all of these more invasive things, I just wanted to remind you that the majority of cases of anorexic tortoises will be solved by just improving husbandry. So that is a reminder that getting a good history and really probing is so important. So if you can fix husbandry deficits, you'll go so far into helping your tortoise patient. And then if that doesn't work, then you can continue down the route of trying to find other primary causes. And hopefully this is your patient after your treatment and improved husbandry, back to eating again. And hopefully this webinar has been a bit helpful for you, not only in deciding how to intervene or when to intervene, but also other things you can do in terms of husbandry guidance and tips and tricks in the hospital to helping your anorexic patient. And I just wanted to quickly end on just some resources that you might use, and these are ones I use all the time for writing lectures for our students and for teaching, so they guide me quite a bit. There's a lot of other resources out there and new ones coming out all the time. This the meter one that I have in the lower left corner, that I'm sorry, the lower right corner, is the newest edition out this January. But there are lots of other texts out there that are fine as well and good resources, the BSAVA manuals, and a lot of other tortoise texts that are easy access for first opinion work. But just wanted to give you an idea of what I kind of turn to when I need to. And a lot of these are online access as well, so it should be easy to get. But again, hopefully that's been helpful for you. Hopefully you've enjoyed the webinar. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to try to answer them. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Bronwyn for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.